The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Do you expect any sort of more assertive stance from European officials when it comes to Belarus, but also when it comes to Russia?
I think that this incident is so outrageous and such a flagrant violation of international rules. And the rhetorical response already has been so strong that there have to be more severe and significant measures. And if the EU fails to act, it's not only Belarus that will draw conclusions about its ability to get away with things like this. Other countries will be watching the EU's reaction too. And that includes Russia.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. The audio you just heard was from CNBC. It's about an extraordinary international incident in which a Belarusian fighter jet intercepted a Ryanair commercial flight that was going from Athens, Greece, to Vilnius, and intercepted it, forced it to land in Minsk, and then arrested a Belarusian dissident. Appeared to be the entire point of the operation here. There's all sorts of indication that this was an intelligence operation. It ordered personally by the dictator of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. There's lots of different international reaction to this. All of it, almost all of it, extremely negative. Russia's Sergei Lavrov has weighed in on this as well. We're going to do a deep dive on this with Elizabeth Brough, who is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where she focuses on defense against emerging national security challenges, such as hybrid and gray zone threats. Currently, she's also a columnist with Foreign Policy, where she writes on national security and the globalized economy, and a member of the National Preparedness Commission of the United Kingdom. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us.
Happy to be with you.
So this is very interesting. What happened here in Minsk is very concerning, I would think, considering the implications of a military intervention in commercial aviation of this sort, and the use of a threat of a bomb, of a bomb threat in what looks to be more or less a ruse just to capture a dissident who happened to be on that flight. Can you tell us a little bit more about maybe what we know and what we don't know so far?
Yes, it's an extremely devious plot. I've never heard of anything like it. I mean, we've heard of hijackers in the past, not just heard of. We have experienced sure. hijackers in the past, but we haven't seen a government essentially mislead the pilots of a commercial airliner with a false threat just to get its hands on one of its citizens, which is what happened in this case. So the details are a bit murky, but what we know is that this Ryanair flight, so Ryanair is the low-cost carrier of Europe, or the biggest low-cost carrier. It's what you fly if you're really on a budget. And
right.
So Ryanair is an airline that wouldn't ordinarily sort of associate itself with any sort of national security issues at all, because it's what sort of low-income European tourists travel on. So this flight was traveling from Athens to Vilnius, which is obviously the capital of Lithuania. And as the plane entered Belarusian territory, it was informed by air traffic control that there was a security threat, and it was instructed to land in Minsk, which is the capital of Belarus. And that's what it did, because as your listeners know, a pilot has to follow the instructions of air traffic control in the country that has the airspace that the airline is traveling through. So it's not like the pilot could have just gone away and said, no, I don't trust you. You have to follow air traffic control. And the point is, air traffic control, they operate professionally. In this case, they did not. And when the Ryanair flight then landed, the Belarusian authorities had everybody leave the flight, and lo and behold, they took this one opposition journalist and his girlfriend, and everybody else was allowed to board. There are conflicting details. There is information that four Russians were also kept, including this journalist's girlfriend, who is Russian. Anyway, the journalist is the protagonist. He was kept in Belarus and is now detained and has just been seen on a recorded sort of confessional video. But the point is that this flight was traveling between two European capitals and it was minding its own business, carrying tourists. And here it is, wrapped up in this geopolitical ugly geopolitical scheming.
It's very interesting, too, Elizabeth, that this was, you mentioned the people that came off the plane, Ireland's foreign minister, and people have to remember that Ryanair is operated out of Ireland. It's, operates all over Europe, but it is an Irish enterprise.
Yep.
And Simon Coveney told RTE, which is an Irish language national broadcaster, that his information was that four other people got off, just like you said, and he felt that those people were probably operatives, agents, secret agents, spies that were trailing this dissident, and so that this was an operation that had been set up pretty well in advance. They knew it was going on, and obviously that makes the exploitation of this even more deliberate. And this was in service of what people often refer to as Europe's last dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, whose recent re-election was, just to put it mildly, questionable, Elizabeth.
Yes, he is... A fierce gentleman. I think it's the kindest thing you can say about him. He has been in charge of Belarus now essentially since the end of the Cold War, meaning since the independence of Belarus when the Soviet Union collapsed. And he's hanging on with every means available. But as you say, the fact that there appear to have been additional people on this flight with the mission of keeping an eye on this journalist suggests that it wasn't just something where the government took advantage of this flight flying over Belarusian airspace to say, well, you know, let's try to get him down here since they are in Belarusian airspace. Anyway, it was a planned action, and the journalist texted friends as he was about to board in Athens, texted friends saying that there are people glancing at my documents, and that suggests that they were there for that specific purpose, clearly. It's interesting also that his girlfriend was detained in Belarus. She's a Russian citizen, but the Russian government has made no complaints about one of its citizens being detained in Belarus. So that's interesting, too. And we should say that this is really the first time that the government has acted like this. We have seen lots of crime on airliners before, but nothing like this, not even when countries are daggers drawn vis-a-vis the country where the airline or the aircraft may be based. Nothing like this, and that makes it so extraordinary.
What I find really extraordinary here, too, or maybe not even so much extraordinary as, well, in this case, expected, Sergei Lavrov, you mentioned the fact that at least one Russian citizen was detained by this. And, of course, there was a number of citizens from various countries, including the United States, that were on that flight that have registered diplomatic objections over this. They're talking about sanctions. We'll get to that in a moment. But Sergei Lavrov, who is the foreign minister of Russia, instead came out and said that Lukashenko had acted absolutely reasonably about this and that people shouldn't rush to judgment. I don't have the exact quote right in front of me. And, I mean, on one sense, that might be surprising. In another sense, if you remember where Belarus is at, and what the implications are for Russia, I don't think anybody was going to doubt for a moment that Lavrov and Vladimir Putin would have come out in support of Lukashenko. They are very concerned about Belarus being pulled into the European orbit in a similar way that happened with Ukraine, in a similar way that was happening with Georgia in 2008.
That's exactly right. And Lukashenko, we have to remember, he is not a perfect ally. In fact, he is extremely annoying because he keeps asking Russia for favors. He keeps getting into trouble, and then Russia has to help him. They have to give him money and so forth. But he is an ally, and that is the situation that Russia is in now. It doesn't have many allies, so it has to help the few imperfect allies it has, and Lukashenko is key among them. So it's not surprising that Russia hasn't complained about this, even though at least one of its citizens has been detained in Belarus. And it will be very interesting to see how this moves forward diplomatically, what Russia decides to do, whether it decides to say nothing, whether it decides to back him up with more than words. It is completely unclear at this moment, and of course what's completely unclear as well is what the EU and the US as well possibly will decide to do, because this really is an attack on the EU. You should be able to travel without fear of being kidnapped within the European Union, from one city in the European Union to another city. Clearly, that is not the case, and that has enormous implications.
Well, let's talk through some of those implications. We're speaking with Elizabeth Braw from the American Enterprise Institute. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. One of the most significant, I think, international incidents in Europe in quite a while. The EU is meeting, or has been meeting today, to try to come up with some response to this. There have been at least some suggestions that they're going to order all EU aircraft to avoid Belarusian airspace, which I think is less of a sanction and more just of a safety issue at this point in time. They're going to have to fly around Belarus in order to keep that from happening again. There's already sanctions on Belarus and Lukashenko and some of the members of his regime because of what happened with the election. What room do they have to add to this? Where do you see the EU response going, and is there really going to be an effective response to this?
Yeah, that is the challenge. So the EU has, as it always does, has expressed concern, and that's what it excels at. This time,
yes,
has expressed grave concern. But you can't just express grave concern and then do nothing. And the EU, we have to remember, are 24 independent nations, and they have to somehow agree on an appropriate or their a combined, a joint way forward. And we have to remember these are countries with very different priorities. Some of our neighbors of Russia, and in fact Belarus, Lithuania, where the flight was supposed to land, is a neighbor of Belarus. But there are also countries that are located very far from Russia and Belarus and don't want to upset the situation. So the EU has to find some sort of lowest common denominator among its 27 member states. And I think what we'll see are probably more sanctions, because that's the answer to almost every act that requires something more than condemnation, but something that less than real action. You impose a few sanctions, and then that feels good. It looks like a muscular response, but it doesn't really achieve very much at all.
I'm curious, Elizabeth, about one thing in regards to Putin's relationship with Lukashenko, which is, as you mentioned, he's not the greatest ally, simply because he's maybe after the late dictator of Turkmenistan, maybe the weirdest of the Soviet, ex-Soviet republic dictators left, and possibly even number one, even historically. I'm curious as to why they're not looking, Putin and Lavrov, why they're not looking to find somebody to transition, go through that sort of transition process to somebody who would be friendly, because they're going to be left in a situation where the people are going to become so dissatisfied with Lukashenko and that regime that they're going to be looking for an Orange Revolution type of event to take place in Belarus, which is going to touch off an even greater Russian response here, because they can't afford to lose Belarus and lose half of Ukraine too.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I think that the big challenge here is that dictators don't do what CEOs do, which is to maintain a succession pipeline. Every CEO has a succession pipeline. They have to. That's right. what the board looks to. So if something happens to the CEO, if there's a scandal, if he or she gets a heart attack, there has to be a succession pipeline. Dictators, they don't do that. I mean, they are obviously larger than life personalities, and they don't want anybody to even remotely challenge their power. So they don't have a succession pipeline. And so it makes it very difficult for an outside country like Russia, even a friendly one, to try to steer that dictator in the direction of maybe thinking of a successor. Because if it's so far from his mind, then not even the most fervent whisper from Russia will make him think in that direction and countenance a successor. So there really is nobody. And we have to remember, after almost three decades in power, Lukashenko, he has had enough time to think about the successor. He hasn't groomed one, and now he has run out of time and opportunities because there really are no credible, ambitious people left. Many of the best people have left the country. Others are in the opposition. So there are no promising candidates either. And that is the unenviable situation that Russia is in. And I know people may feel, so I'm familiar with the concept of maybe of feeling sorry for Russia. But in this case, we do have to feel a bit sorry for Russia, because even if we wanted to steer Belarus in that direction, it's virtually powerless at this point.
And there's really not going to be a whole lot of impact that the EU can have on Belarus, because Belarus wasn't really Western-facing in the first place. They can apply sanctions. They've done that before. Lukashenko and his regime are mainly doing business with Russia. Russia's obviously not going to apply sanctions here, again, because they want to keep Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia as buffer states against Western influence in Russia proper. And so this is the same conundrum that we have, I think, that we did have in Ukraine earlier, which is that sanctions on a regime, this is pre-2014, obviously, after things changed in Ukraine, sanctions on a regime that really doesn't do a whole lot of business with you in the first place, the impact of that's going to be rather limited. How much air traffic commerce took place between Belarus and EU? Because I was thinking that perhaps the one area that you could apply that would be to simply lock out Belarus from engaging in aviation in the rest of Europe until they release this particular dissident and return him back to, I believe, was he living in Romania, or was he actually living in Greece? I forget exactly where he was basing himself out of.
I believe he had received political asylum in Poland, which is
Poland,
of course, another neighbor, and a neighbor of Lithuania as well. Yeah. So regarding the air traffic, so it was interesting actually to look at the map on Sunday. Belarusian airspace is quite frequently traversed, but mostly by flights traveling through it, not landing in Belarus, because Minsk is not a hugely attractive destination. But there are many arrivals, surprisingly many arrivals from various European cities every day. For example, Berlin, Frankfurt, Paris, Rome. So it is, as I said, surprisingly, has a surprising amount of traffic, a lot of it by the Belarusian state airline, but still there are flights. And what we've seen today, meaning this day, is that both Lithuania, Sweden, and the UK, and now there are possibly others in the last couple of hours as well, those countries have either banned Belarusian flights from coming into the country or from going to Belarus. So Belarusian airspace and the airport in Minsk are going to look quite a bit emptier as a result. And I think that will be something that will embarrass and humiliate Lukashenko, because he wants to be seen as a leading ruler. And then all of a sudden he's isolated in his little country with very little traffic coming in or going out. And I think actually that could be quite an effective tool if more countries decide to impose similar rules.
Well, I think it will matter more to individual Belarusians. One of the problems with sanctions on regime members is, again, especially when you're dealing with Belarus and others that are in that Russian orbit, is that they generally aren't doing a whole lot of business that direction anyway. They're generally doing business in the direction of Moscow. But having that international traffic, having that international engagement, that's something that is a little bit more visible to ordinary Belarusians. And I think that if the EU acts to cut that off, and that will cause some economic pain in the EU as well, and it's at this particular time coming out of the pandemic, they probably aren't terribly happy to have to do this. But I do think that that type of sanction would have more visibility, and it would be more difficult for Lukashenko to explain the sudden absence of foreigners coming in there to do business and to spread euros around after this incident. That in all of this, by the way, in service of arresting a blogger, essentially a blogger. I mean, to me the sense of proportion is so unusual here as well.
Oh, it is. And this is a young man, about 25 years old, who nobody had heard of, nobody outside Belarus had heard of before Sunday. And now he's a household name. Leaders of the world are weighing in on his behalf. It's such a massive miscalculation by the Belarusian authorities. It's incomprehensible that they could have risked so much just to get this one guy, and clearly they miscalculated terribly.
So what should we got about a minute left, Elizabeth. What should we look for in the next 24 to 48 hours? Do you think that it's possible that Lukashenko will back off? Do you think it's possible that Russia will try to broker some sort of a settlement? Or do you think that they're going to just wait this out and let the West hang fire?
I think we'll see more countries banning ingoing and outgoing flights to and from Minsk. And we'll also, I think, see some sort of Russian negotiation that allows Lukashenko to save face and then the blogger to be released, because the European leaders are not going to back off. They have so many times they've said they're gravely concerned. Now this time public opinion is not going to let them get away with just saying they're concerned. So there is this enormous pressure on them to do something, which means that Lukashenko will have to back down.
I think you're probably right about that, Elizabeth Braw, American Enterprise Institute. Thanks so much for being with us. When we come back, Austin Roos, the author of Under Siege. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Have you been away from the faith for a long time? You're welcome here. The Drew Mariani Show is live and here for you now on Relevant Radio.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. With everything that's going wrong in the world, you might be surprised to find out that there's no better time to be a member of the Catholic Church. Here to tell us exactly why that is and explain that thesis in his new book, Under Siege, is Austin Roos, the president of the Center for Family and Human Rights. Austin and his team have participated in every major UN social policy negotiation since 1997. You can find them online at c-fam.org. He's also a regular columnist at Crisis Magazine, and he's out with his new book, Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. And Austin, my friend, great to talk to you again.
I am all charged up to talk to you.
I got to tell you, Austin. I mean, it's you make reference in the book to Roman times, and you know how at least we're, well, at least it's not Rome, but it's getting there. we haven't gotten to Diocletian yet, but it's getting there. We're going in the wrong direction, but that means that there's no finer time for us to stand up for our faith.
You know, it's interesting because in Roman times, it was, you know, the dominant, of course, religion were the pagans, and the religion that was, you know, gaining ground was the Christians. And now what's you know, the dominant culture here is really Christianity, but it appears that the pagans have begun to take over and are making great advances on us. But, you know, I argue in the book, and as I've talked to you on your podcast, there's never been a finer time to be a faithful Catholic precisely because of that. You know, as I say in the book, you know, God knows what he's about. And who did he send at these desperate moments but the likes of you and me? How crazy is that?
Well, speaking for myself, very crazy, but I do feel blessed, Austin, that this...
Yeah.
Now, this is a very entertaining book, and I have to say, anybody who starts off in their introduction naming two of my favorite movies, that's the book for me. Blade Runner, you make a reference to Blade Runner, and you make a reference to Full Metal Jacket, and wow. I have to say, I think we must have been hanging out at the same movie theaters together at about the same time. These are great references in the argument that you set up, and I mean, this is obviously, this is not... movie hour. I do that with Christian Toto, but
yeah.
I mean, this is a very entertaining book. This is not a dry academic tome. I mean, you're really engaging here in a lot of cultural touchstones here that people can really relate to, not just in terms of their Catholic faith, but in terms of their everyday lives. And I think that that's part of what the message is here, is that we're called to keep engaging.
Well, you know, I can't let it go without quoting Roy Blatty in his final moments in Blade Runner when he said, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. I've seen attack ships on fire up the shoulder of Orion. I've seen sea beams dance in this tent near the Tannhauser Gate. All these things will be lost in time to die. Now, I'm not that bleak, but in my journalism and in the work that I do at CFAM, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. And part of my role, as I see it in my journalism and in this book, is to look at what's really going on and then turn around and tell people what I see and what I know. You know, the first chapter is entitled, I'm Lazarus, come from the dead, come back to tell you all. That's a line from T.S. Eliot. I feel like I've seen quite a bit in the U.N. negotiations, but also in the wider culture. There's a temptation, and you and I have talked about this before, to look away, to distract yourself, to live in fear. And I say, let's live in the present moment, because this is where he has sent us, and we just can't avoid it. I mean, we can, but we shouldn't.
Well, and that's the point. That's the point of the second movie reference, and I've got to go with this on Full Metal Jacket, where you draw the distinction between cowboy and animal mother. In cowboy, there's a lot of incoming fire, and he ducks down to avoid it. And animal mother, who is played by a friend of mine, Adam Baldwin, who's just basically brilliant in this film, decides that you can't just sit there and let a sniper rain down fire on you, and he charges. And there's an irony in that. And I mean, Full Metal Jacket's been out for 20 something years, folks. So if this is a spoiler, I'm sorry that we're going to do this. But it's Cowboy who ends up paying the price for his hesitation rather than Animal Mother, who is the person who goes on to confront this. And in your
That's
book,
exactly
you make a great point about this courage, especially courage in tough situations, and I would argue in this case where you were working on behalf of the Holy Spirit, courage is its own protection. Courage is its own shield to some extent. Doesn't mean you're not going to get hurt. Doesn't mean you're not going to take damage. But it does mean that you're better off being assertive about your faith and better off being assertive about these issues than you are in hunkering down. And there are a lot of people who write about hunkering down. You've heard about the Benedict option. You've heard about people who want to go back to a sort of a monastic sense to recover the quietness of Christianity as a way to overcome this. I think there's value in that argument as well, but I don't know that it's what we're called to do.
You know, there the line from Cowboy in that movie where he says, "We cannot refuse to accept the situation," I took to heart for a good long while, but I realized upon seeing the movie again when I was writing this book that I got that wrong. He wants us to accept the situation. And Animal Mother says, "No, we're not going to accept the situation. We're going to charge the sniper's nest." Well, you know, not everybody is like the two of us, you know, charging the sniper's nest. A lot of people simply can't, because of their station in life, charge the sniper's nest.
Sure.
But the point that I make in the book is that there's something for everybody to do. I mean, from, you know, writing a check to your favorite pro-life group or a group that's fighting porn, or going down to the local school board and shaking the hand of the lone school board guy who's, you know, upholding the truth. I mean, there's all the way unto charging the sniper's nest. But you know, a lot of people are missing this moment for a whole host of reasons. It's pretty scary out there. If
yes.
I worked in like a major corporation, I'd be worried. There's no question about that. But that doesn't mean you can't, you know, fold up a nice $20 bill and send it down to the local pro-life and pro-family group. There's stuff for everybody to do. So I totally understand. I mean, I'm living a little bit of the Benedict option. I live in Northern Virginia. I go to a very Orthodox parish. There's, you know, 100 mission-oriented families in the immediate vicinity. But I mean, you know, everybody is in one way or another engaged. And that's what the book is about, is not missing the present moment, and that we are living through one of the most remarkable epochs the church has ever known. And I don't want anybody to miss it.
We are speaking with Austin Roos and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, about his book, Under Siege, which you can get from Sophia Institute Press. You can find it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. You can find it in your bookstores. And yeah, this is, I think, there's all sorts of people who will tell you that this is, that we're entering new persecutions and that it's, you know, life is terrible and it's going to get worse and all of that. You're one of the few who are saying, and take joy in this because this is your moment. But I mean, you're not soft pedaling this moment either. I mean, you talk about here the rise of a new state church, or the new state church, and also the unholy Inquisition. And this is this particular point, and you just raised this, and I want to raise this again, because I think that this is what really defines the secular church, if you will, or the state church, is that it is a church that is all sin and no forgiveness. There is no redemption. It's all sin, no redemption.
Right.
And it is,
right.
I mean, that's bleak. I mean, what we're offering is so much more, is so much more joyful, which is that, yes, we're all imperfect. Yes, we all fail, but we can be forgiven, and God loves us and wants us to be forgiven. And we need to forgive each other just as God forgives us. In the popular culture church, if you will, that concept is completely missing. There is no redemption. There is no forgiveness. All there is various degrees of a lifetime of punishment, driven in large part by social media, where everything lives forever.
One of the stories that I tell in a previous book, Fake Science, is the story of a climate scientist named Roger Pilka, University of Colorado.
Yes.
Who is fully on board with, you know, the catastrophic notion of climate change, man-made, yada, yada, yada. But he disagreed on a little piece of it. He said, there are not more storms, and the damage that we're seeing from storms is because we're building, you know, McMansions on the beach these days. And for this slight indiscretion, he was read out of the climate, you know, movement, and he's not even teaching that anymore. I think he's teaching something about some athletic thing. So, there is no forgiveness, and they will run you right out of town. And it's gotten worse because of the rise of the denomination of the wokesters. there are many denominations in this new church, and one of the most recent one, and we saw this last summer during all the riots, you know, people kneeling down and intoning basically prayers led by leaders of Black Lives Matter or shining the shoes of African Americans or all of this kind of debasement. So there are new denominations in the New State Church. But I want the listeners to understand my argument about the New State Church, that, you know, it really began when the Supreme Court decided in the Bible reading case in 1963 that the Bible could not be read in public schools. In that case, they determined that the object and purpose of government has to be secular. And what that has come to mean is without God. Additionally, they have taken on certain ideas, you know, with the contraception decisions in the 60s and then Roe v. Wade in 1973, sodomy decisions in recent decades, and then Obergefell in 2015. All of these things have been imposed by the federal government on us, and they reverberate down to the Department of Justice, Department of Education, on down to the local grade school, where we used to tell the story that we believe in divine providence, and now we tell the story that boys can be girls, that you're born in the wrong body, sex is assigned at birth, and all of these are faith claims. This is one of the primary arguments I make in the book.
Right. These are all. It's almost one of the most one of the oxymorons, I think, that really define our just our recent age here is the phrase "believe the science."
Oh.
Right. And I mean, and I know you, I think you discussed this as well, but you don't need to believe science. Science is demonstrable. Science is repeatable. There's no need to believe it. Once it's established, you can establish it, but you can also question it because it's science and you're supposed to be able to challenge it and you're supposed to be able to test it. It's testable.
Right.
If it's testable, it's science. If it's not testable, it's a belief. And even when we're talking about science now, it's being treated as a belief system that cannot be called into question, that can never be tested.
That's
it has become its own religion, scientism.
There is no, well, yeah, absolutely. There is no objective criteria. There's no objective scientific criteria for believing that you are two-spirit or non-binary or any of the other 58 or 60 genders. There's no objective scientific criteria. It's based on a subjective feeling. Yet if you challenge this, the pushback is so intense that it can only be explained by the idea that you're challenging an aspect of somebody's faith and not science. So scientism indeed. And the priesthood of the New State Church are anybody who wears a robe, judges, academics, scientists. And the new faithful go to them for the encyclicals that they have to believe in, that boys can be girls, that the world is about to end because of climate change, and all of this, and none of that can be challenged, or you can lose your job, you can be kicked off of social media, and a whole host of things. Yeah. However, I don't want the listeners to think that this is a bleak book, because it's not. I argue that we are living through a remarkable time in the church. You know, beginning with, you know, the Long Lent in 2002 and going up to the present day, there are a series of events that show that the world is obsessed with the Catholic Church. The world can't get enough of what we believe, what we say, what we do. It is a remarkable time. And so the book is not bleak. The book is really hopeful.
I want to go on that, and not to keep emphasizing the bleak, because this is really what sets Under Siege aside, which is that it's hope, it's joy in the moment. It gives us an opportunity to see this these challenges from a completely different perspective. But let's talk a little bit more about the challenges here as well. And you mentioned the fact that they're really going after the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church is one of the last bastions of consistent belief. And pushback in many cases, maybe not as much as some would like in certain topics, but consistency in focusing on truth, truth, beauty, and love, and you can't do that. You can't have that in this new state church. The state church has to be completely malleable. All of your doctrines have to be open to change almost on a whim. And so the Catholic Church really ends up being the antithesis of this.
Well, you know, I quote that there's a speechwriter named William Gavin who's written books on speeches. And he said, he points out that whenever the left takes over, their number one enemy is always the Roman Catholic Church. And so much of this began in the French Revolution. And the two enemies to the revolutionaries were the Catholic Church and the family. And we see that today. And it's because both of them are divinely created, and therefore they have to be the enemy. So this is why the left delights in going after the Catholic Church and no other institution, and no other institution has ever, you know, remained four square on the question of abortion or marriage or the great third rail of Catholic teaching and politics, contraception. So they know who their enemy is, and it is this rock solid institution called the Catholic Church. And yes, we have gone through travails in the Catholic Church, but that's also part of the reason why it's a remarkable time to be alive, because we get to work on that too. He has given us a full plate of things to work on. And folks shouldn't miss it. They can't miss it.
We are speaking with Austin Roos, talking about his book, Under Siege. So stick with us past the break. When we come back, we'll take your calls at 888-914-9149. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Hey, hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call.
All the issues.
Has also been a victim of vandalism now.
All the topics.
Prevent these things.
One place. The Drew Mariani Show.
But we have to cooperate with prayer.
On Relevant Radio. We go there.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, talking to my friend Austin Roos of CFAM.org about his new book, Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. Before we get back to that, though, let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Missy from Chicago. Welcome to the conversation.
Hi, how are you?
Doing
hey,
fine,
Missy. I just got
Missy.
Drew Mariani's book today through the mail. I was so happy
great.
To get it. Yeah, and I'm not even Catholic. I was so excited to get it, though.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, I just appreciated you having your guests on. I really appreciate it, because I remember about 30 years ago, I began researching the government school system and decided to homeschool my children. And back then, you didn't just hop on the Internet, and I saw this coming. And so I just decided to homeschool my kids, and they're out there today in the world, and they are bold, and they are in your face, just like the leftists, just like the anti-Catholics are, just like the anti-Christians are. They are right there because they learned, and they know, and they keep on learning. And people were telling me, you got to leave them in school. You got to put them in the lion's den. I said, uh-uh, they walk into the zoo first. When they grow up, they're going to be in the lion's den. They're going to be prepared. They're going to see what's out there, and they know now. You know,
Missy,
they're not little girls who look like the, you know, who are in the long dresses and no makeup. I mean, they're beautiful girls. They got makeup, they got tattoos, but they're believers. They're right in their face, and they know what's going on.
Well, Missy, thank you so much for your call. And Austin, again, talking about Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. You know, it's an interesting perspective on homeschooling. And I think that maybe in the pandemic, this is going to be an even bigger phenomenon than it has been. And it's been growing for a long time. But this idea that maybe it's not dropping out, but providing an alternate way of formation for children who simply shouldn't really be going through the public school system in the way it's currently configured. I think there are a lot of parents of faith who do want their kids to be engaged in the world, but they want them to be formed well first. And This is the type of thing I think that, you know, if Missy's reading your book, she might feel even better about the decision that she made here.
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, Missy identified herself as not a Catholic, and I want any non-Catholic listeners to understand that this book is for them too,
yep.
Because it's no finer time to be a faithful Christian. One of the things I say is I have more in common with a hard-nosed Calvinist than I do with a dissenting Catholic. I call our movement the real ecumenism, that is, people of strong faith, putting aside theological and ecclesiological differences and banding together to fight an enemy that's coming for all of us. So with regard to the public schools, I mean, I know that not everybody can take their kids out of the public schools, but man, oh man, we pledged, Kathy and I, that our children would never, ever, ever darken the door of the public school. Even so, Kathy works hard on alerting parents to what's going on in the public schools here in Northern Virginia. It's purely awful. And you know what? They hide it from parents, too. You know, a lot of the nasty sex ed stuff, it flies under different names in different classes. They actively try to hide it from parents. My joke is, we'd rather live in a double wide down near the river than send our kids to a public school. The joke is that all the rich people actually have the riverfront property. But
right.
I commend to people Mary Hassan's book on public education and the importance of getting kids out. You know, one of the benefits, I think, of the pandemic is that a lot of parents learned that they could homeschool. They probably thought that they couldn't, because it does seem immense and strange and hard. And what they learned in the pandemic is that they could. I think, you know, private education in schools that are on mission, you can't even trust all private schools. You can't trust all, parish schools. You have to find one that's really on mission and teaching the right stuff. But, yeah, my heart goes out to the kids who are trapped in these public schools.
Austin, we're speaking with Austin Roos about his new book, Under Siege, and you can get that from Sophia Institute Press. SophiaInstitute.com is where you can find that, or you can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of these fine bookstores to buy Under Siege. Now, you talk about, we talked about a lot of the different things. We spent a lot of time on the dark side of this issue. But let's talk a little bit about the joy side here. You write, live not by fear, right? I mean, that this is a time of, while there's great dangers, there are, serious issues here. This is a time where faithful Catholics, faithful Christians can take joy in knowing that they are sort of on the leading edge, the tip of the spear of the Holy Spirit's mission here on earth.
Look at the generations that we look back with envy and admire, the founding generation who had to fight a war. We look back with admiration upon the Civil War generation who fought to free the slaves. We look back upon the generation that fought in the Second World War, the greatest generation. We are that generation. We are fighting a great enemy. That is actually taking bodies and souls. I mean, the body count from abortion alone is 60 million or more. And you add in sexually transmitted diseases and all that stuff and broken families. It's immense what we're fighting. But we are that generation that has been sent right now to fight that battle. People have to take heart that we're in the right time and the right place, just like these previous generations.
Well, and I think that what we also have to take heart in is that the promises of this secular religion that we are up against are so empty, and we have the answer to fill the emptiness that this produces. Before we get to that, though, let's go to Pat from Minnesota. I'm sorry, Pat from Minnesota was going to say something about homeschooling. She's dropped off the line. But, I mean, we have the message that fills that emptiness, Austin, that addresses the hole in the hearts of men and women that are looking for truth, that are looking for groundedness, and that are looking for a pathway to God.
Well, one of the things I write about in the book is this idea that we live in a secular society and that so many people are stepping away from religious belief. You know, they're checking the, nun box. You know, I'm no longer
right.
A Christian. I'm none of the above. I argue we're living in an intensely religious time. you know, when you look at all these people that have become nuns, they're not becoming nuns. They're becoming something, and they're searching. You know, a lot of them have, you know, become pantheists. So, you know, if you look at Gwyneth Paltrow and her company and the show that she has on Netflix, you know, they believe in energy, and there are people who believe in spirits. I mean, in a Pew poll that I cite in the book, even atheists, a certain percentage of atheists, believe that God plays an important part in their lives. I mean, this is one of the wacky things about American religion, that even the atheists believe in God, some of them. We do not live in a remarkably secular age. And so all of these, you know, Jody Bottom argued that in his book, An Anxious Age, that we need a thicker religion, we need a thicker faith. And actually, we see that. In the Catholic Church, there are more processions through the streets. They're, you know, committed to the rosary, group rosary, the Divine Mercy chaplet, you know, increased reverence for the saints. This is happening right now. I mean, people say, oh, the Catholic Church is declining. You know, what's declining in the Catholic Church are people who don't necessarily believe in the first place. What's really exploding in the Catholic Church are all the pockets of orthodoxy. When I was looking to convert in the 80s, I didn't know what books to read, and nobody could tell me. But now there are how many book publishing companies of orthodox material? A dozen? More? I mean, even there's one called Angelico Press that's run out of a friend of mine apartment in Brooklyn, John and Kari Reese. They're pumping out great books. I publish for Sophie Institute Press. I publish for TAN. There's Ignatius. There are so many. There's a new imprint that publishes old great books called Clooney Media. There is great growth and strength in the orthodox part of not just the Catholic Church, but also the Christian, the Protestant denominations.
Austin Roos, author of Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. Thank you so much for being with us. Coming up next, The Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.